Good afternoon. It's Tuesday, the 14th of March, 2017, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Brian Gerrish. With me in the studio, of course, Mike Robinson. Well, it's still a lovely spring day here in Plymouth, and we'll leave it at that and move on to NATO.
Yes, Jens Stoltenberg has released the 2016 annual report. It says at no point since the end of the Cold War has the NATO alliance faced greater challenges to their security than it does today.
So the Cold War is over.
That's what they say. But they say that since 2014, we've had to adapt again. They have had to adapt again. Russia's illegal annexation of Crimea is the main reason. ISIS is another one, but it was mainly Russia. And as a result, NATO has tripled the size of the NATO response force to 40,000, established a 5,000-strong, very high readiness joint task force, ready to move within days, and they've set up 8 small headquarters in the eastern part of their alliance. To be honest, there's not too much in this report that anybody should be surprised with if they've been watching the UK column for the last year or two. They point out that they have deployed 4 multinational battle groups to Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania and Poland, with the contribution of 17 allied countries. So there's the little infographic. No pressure on Russia there at all. They're also projecting stability. So GNC, Bosnia, Herzegovina, Kosovo, Tunisia, Jordan, Mauritania, Kuwait, Afghanistan, Iraq, Georgia, Moldova, Ukraine, they are projecting stability in all those places.
Projecting stability, not projecting instability.
I think that was maybe a typo. They forgot about the in.
Okay.
Yes.
Can I just say, Mike, on those troops, 40,000 troops, we're not really talking about huge numbers of troops, but there was a very interesting little YouTube video clip. I can't remember the American general's name, but he was being interviewed. And what he said is, we've got a big problem in NATO because we can't move our forces fast enough in the eastern part of Europe. And his prediction was that the Russians were simply going to wipe those forces out in a matter of days. So we've got all this high-level posturing. We've got all of the glitzy publicity material. We've got antagonising Russia. But actually, we've got a shambles on the ground. And the European unified armed forces in the background, of course.
Well, we'll be coming on to that. They said that cybersecurity is another key concern. It's an area in which NATO is making good progress. 2016, NATO dealt with 500 cyber incidents per month, and that was a 60% increase in 2015, if you believe that. I don't know whether I do. What did Jens Stoltenberg have to say? Well, he said another key focus will be tightening our ties with international partners such as the European Union. Actually, he went a little bit further because in the text it says above all the European Union. So this is the key relationship that they're trying to develop at the moment. The report says in 2016 the alliance expanded its contacts with organizations such as the Council of Europe, the World Bank, the African Union, the United Nations, the Committee of the Red Cross, the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, and above all the European Union. The long-standing strategic partnership between NATO and the European Union was taken to a new level in 2016. Later in the year, in the margins of the NATO summit in Warsaw, NATO Secretary General Stoltenberg, together with the President of the European Council, Donald Tusk, and the President of the European Commission, Jean-Claude Juncker, signed a joint declaration in which they identified 7 key areas for closer cooperation, and that was countering hybrid threats, operational cooperation, including maritime issues, cybersecurity, defence capabilities, defence industry and research, exercises, and defence and security capacity building. And the joint declaration also outlined a series of principles upon which this new cooperation would be built. And of course, it has the full support of the EU's High Representative for Foreign Affairs and Security Policy, Federica Mogherini. And they have identified more than 40 concrete actions for cooperation. The proposals were endorsed in parallel by both the NATO and EU foreign ministers in December. But correct me if I'm wrong, Brian, there's quite a bit of overlap between NATO and EU foreign ministers because quite a number of EU countries are also NATO countries.
So yeah, this is true. We need to do some detailed analysis on this, Mike, because the picture is getting so, interwoven. It's getting difficult to pull it apart. So I think we'll do some work on this. But we've got this magic statement in the background, which has been leaked by our Conservative MEP, that basically Europe doesn't want any rapprochement between Trump and Putin, because that will make it bad for the formation of the EU forces. Meanwhile, presumably, President Trump is trying to quiet things down with Putin.
What can we say? Basically, as I said, there's not much in this report that should come as any surprise to anybody that's been following what we've been talking about for the last year or two. But the key item that was highlighted in was the relationship with the European Union. Right. In the meantime, the European Union not making any friends with Russia. They've decided to prolong the anti-Russian sanctions. TASS here reporting that the Minsk Accords have failed to be implemented to this day through Kiev's fault. So the EU Council's decision to prolong sanctions against Russia is regrettable. And that was according to Maria Zakharova, the foreign ministry spokeswoman. She said the EU's decision is regrettable. There have been little progress in implementing the Minsk Accords. Russia's retaliatory stop list remains in effect too, but this is no choice of ours. So the EU maintains a blacklist of Russian and Ukrainian citizens for 6 months, that will expire in September of this year if it isn't renewed once again. On the sanction list, there are 150 people, including Russian officials, politicians, businessmen, and law enforcement. Clearly, the EU not prepared to move on this just yet.
Well, they've been told off. But Russia's been told off by the EU.
Yes.
Those nasty Russians, as we often say.
Indeed. And in the meantime, more US troops into Syria. Sources, various news reports about this, various figures, but it certainly seems like it's between 100 and 200 more US Marines being deployed to the northeast of Hasaka. This is around the Raqqa area. And as we say, the race is on for Raqqa because the Syrian army seems to be pressing in from the west and the US coming in from the northeast. The Arabic desk of Sky News said that 200 soldiers had been deployed to Manbij. So that is a total of 700 US soldiers in that area at the moment. And of course, as we pointed out yesterday, these guys have not been invited. So it is an invasion, and we're seeing more and more reports of civilian casualties as a result of US action at the moment.
Of course, the other thing we need to remember is that it's air power that's the decider in this thing. So at the moment, if the US and UK are not able to fly over Syria, these ground troops are going to be doing what? They're going to be organising, they're going to be training, they're going to be the special forces in on the ground. But without air support, immensely vulnerable. So it's going to be interesting to see what now happens as far as the Russian support for Assad.
Yes. Now, in the chat box, they're saying Raqqa needs clearing from ISIS. This is absolutely true. Raqqa does need to be cleared out of ISIS. Of course, what are the US doing there? Are they there to get rid of ISIS or are they there to protect ISIS? I don't think they want to see another Aleppo situation developing.
Presumably they're there to support the friendly terrorists.
Yes, if we can tell the difference. Okay, let's come back to the UK then. The Surveillance Camera Commissioner has launched a national surveillance camera strategy for England and Wales. I've labelled this a massive invasion of privacy. The basis of this is that they are saying the available evidence indicates that the public remains supportive of the use of surveillance cameras. They say that research in 2014 showed 86% of people support the use of CCTV in public places. But the point that's being made in this report is that although as the way devices are used changes, such as increased use of automatic facial recognition and body-worn video, that the public may become a bit more reticent to support the use of video cameras.
So this is a phishing exercise to see what they can get away with next.
The phishing exercise has come in the last 8 weeks or so because they produced an interim report back in October and then they asked for public comment on that. And this is the result of that public comment. Tony Porter, who is the commissioner, launched the strategy. He has said he's worried about overt surveillance becoming much more invasive, because it's linked to everything else. So one example that they gave in the report was that in 2016, the Metropolitan Police had been using automatic facial recognition at the Notting Hill Carnival. So the police were walking around through the crowds at the carnival with body-worn cameras, which are linked to the National Crime Database. And then facial recognition was being used to see who was there and try to identify criminal activity. But the question is whether that's the limit of it. Who else's face appeared on that via that camera?
Yeah.
Were their activities recorded? We don't know. So Tony Porter is absolutely raising a flag on this. And the other issue that he's raising, the point that he's making, is he said that a recent report by Big Brother Watch had shown a 46.6% decrease on funding spent on the installation, maintaining and monitoring of CCTV by local authorities since 2012, from around £515 million to approximately £277 million. The report says this downturn in spend is likely to indicate some councils switching off or reducing their CCTV provision. In 2015-16, towns such as Havant and Newbury have switched off schemes to save money, and Westminster Council has also questioned their role in the provision of monitored CCTV. And this, I think, is the key point, because what we're looking at there is the privatisation of this. And that, of course, becomes much more difficult then to hold anybody to account, because private companies tend not to be held to the Freedom of Information Act, even though they're supposed to when they're providing a service
for public authority.
Yes. Yeah. He was describing this in The Guardian as a nightmare scenario, a lack of understanding about how big data and how effective this can be. The technology is here to protect us, but this needs to be informed consent about what it's capable of doing. And he's suggesting that neither the government nor the public actually appreciate where we're going.
There's another angle on this, Mike, and that is I watch with interest, as the government says, and we've mentioned it in the NATO report, that cyber security is one of the key issues, that cyber attacks, key threat to UK and the Western world. And yet, if we look at what the government is doing in UK at the moment, it's centralising every single bit of data collection. So if I was given the job of doing something to protect our cyber infrastructure, the first thing I'd be looking at was decentralising it so that it was decentralised and compartmentalised. We are doing the opposite. The government is linking everything together, which of course means that if there's a hack, it's going to go everywhere.
And the other point that's made in the report, of course, they raise the issue of the fact that the Internet of Things and so many devices which may be classed as surveillance in one form or another, whether it be smart meters to cameras to simple webcams, yep, on the internet with almost no security protection there at all.
At all. Okay, well, what are we going to do about all this? The key thing is that people understand what's happening and they're able to talk, meet and discuss it. And so we will say that Saturday, the 26th of April, 2017, we have this wonderful hall in Nottingham, which is designed to bring people together who, in principle, are awake, who are out there trying to stop the worst of the excesses of this dictatorship, which is installing itself. If you haven't got a ticket for that event, it is only £10. We understand that travel is another cost on top. However, here is the space for people to come together and exchange ideas.
Can I just say it's the 22nd of April, not the 26th?
22nd of April.
Yes.
Okay. I'll put my glasses on for the next bit. Now, we'll just bring this up on screen. You can freeze the screen to read it if you want, but we just want to say this is somebody taking really excellent action and very simply. So this was sent in to us today. It's an email which has been sent to most of the London LBC presenters. Dear Nick and fellow LBC presenters, government policy to cover up the abuse of children. Please view the attached video of Tim Fortescue, Chief Whip, 1970-73. It was originally broadcast in 1995. In it, Tim Fortescue, Chief Whip, reveals it was government policy to cover up the sexual abuse of children within the Conservative Party. They then give a little transcript in this email. They give a little transcript of what Tim Fortescue said. They've also attached a copy of a letter that Robert Greene has written to Paul Dacre, the editor of the Daily Mail. The subject of this letter is his concern that some of Mr. Dacre's journalists may be undermining the validity of Chief Constable Mike Veal's investigation into the serious allegations made against Edward Heath relating to sexual crimes committed against children. So what we've got here is a very concise email, which simply means that LBC will never be able to say they didn't know. I think this is a really powerful email. It shows what people can do when they've got the information in front of them, and we'll be fascinated to see, to hear what comes back from LBC. But Tim Fortescue's video clip is easily found on YouTube. If you haven't seen it, please do, because in it he simply says that the policy of the whips was to help cover up the abuse of children in order to, I'll use inverted commas, blackmail politicians into then doing what the whips wanted. But no child abuse in Westminster, according to David Cameron or Theresa May. A big thank you to those that have donated to the UK column. This little one came through. Somebody's tried to donate from the States but had a problem. We're going to say thank you for trying. I'm sure there's some other ways to get a donation through to the UK column. We did receive this little card this morning with a donation, and we're going to say a very big thank you for that support. Now, AV8 is coming up. I'll read the date. I hope I get it right this time, which is the 19th to the 22nd of May. And I am one of the speakers. I will be talking about the cult of transformational newspeak and how we break away from it. Why did I choose that title? Well, because for a very long time, UK Column has been watching the use of language, or the corruption of language, to achieve political purposes. And it's quite clear to us that this is now speeding up. So let's bring in the subject of mindfulness. And we are particularly concerned to see this now being spread into schools, and it's being targeted against younger and younger children. So here's the BBC headline: mindfulness to help children's mental well-being in schools. We've got another one here: can mindfulness improve pupils' concentration? And if you Google mindfulness and mindfulness in British schools, you're going to find article after article as this pernicious, I'll call it a fad, but there's more to it, spreads. Well, if we have a look at this BBC article, it's fascinating because it quotes political author, former head of Wellington College and Vice Chancellor of Buckingham University, Sir Anthony Seldon. He's called for daily stillness sessions in schools. There's been a decline in traditional religious assemblies where people might have quiet time and in fact pray. We're going to get rid of all of that. We're going to have mindfulness, and that's going to be pushed out across all of the schools. So it says here, so can mindfulness meditation really help schools, pupils concentrate amid the distractions of 21st century living? A group of BBC school reporters from Connaught School for Girls decided to investigate. So the BBC uses 14-year-old schoolgirls in order to investigate mindfulness. And I'll just add this one in. In October, the Mindfulness All-Party Parliamentary Group said the practice should be made more widely available. Now, my immediate comment on this, Mike, is how remarkable that we are literally playing around with the minds of young children. And who do we ask to investigate but young 14-year-old students that the BBC is apparently trained as investigative journalists?
And have they already been subject to mindfulness training?
I don't know that, Mike, but of course, what did they come back with? A glowing report on the effects of mindfulness without actually investigating what's actually been done to their minds in the first place. This is very, very dangerous stuff. This is the organised organisation mentioned. So we've got Mindfulness in School project. Courage as always, people go and have a look at this stuff. Board of Trustees here. Amanda Bailey is the lead coach. We'll come on to her in a moment. But what I was intrigued to see on the second half of this is it's Anthony Seldon himself. So in the BBC article, the BBC simply fails to declare that Anthony Seldon's got an interest in a key part of their report. So that's not Anthony Seldon's problem, that's the BBC's problem. But nevertheless, very deceptive, devious reporting by the BBC. So let's bring in the lady herself, Head of Coaching North. I think this is the right lady. Have a look at this report here, because there is page after page of the benefits of mindfulness. And of course, it's labelling here that we're going back to Buddhist traditions 2,500 years ago.
Well, that's very interesting. It says there, however, we should also remember that secular mindfulness has its roots in Buddhist traditions going back 2,500 years. But the fact of the matter is that the Buddhist community has absolutely raised concerns about the fact of secular mindfulness. They're saying that the mindfulness that they teach is rooted in Buddhist spiritual tradition, and that this is rooted in nothing and potentially quite dangerous.
I just noted in this lady's text here that it says there is still widespread confusion about mindfulness, what mindfulness is, and how it can be practiced. So we're introducing a practice about which there's widespread confusion. We're already introducing it into schools, and we have no idea what the real risks are to the children. We've emailed one of these organisations this morning to ask what due diligence they've done on the risks to the minds of children. We haven't had a reply yet. If we get a reply, of course, we will make that available to viewers. So if we come back to MISP, have a look, because they're now networked worldwide. So we've got links to the Czech Republic, the States, into Europe, into children's charities. This thing is spreading like wildfire. And I have to say, I originally thought this was a sort of generic marketing exercise which was spreading this mindfulness throughout the country. However, that's clearly not the case. So if we come back to that BBC report, what they flagged up is an all-party working group on mindfulness. And in the report centre screen, we've got another number of areas that the government is recommending that we have to have mindfulness in health, we have to have it in education, we have to have it in the workplace, and we have to have it within the criminal and justice system. So basically, Mike, this is being driven through the community. There's been no open debate. I don't remember a debate in Westminster about the benefits and risks of mindfulness. But what we've got is this all-party parliamentary group, which is simply pushing it into position.
And what qualifications do people have that are pushing this into the health, education, workplace and criminal justice system?
Well, at the moment, I can find none. And of course, if you get into what mindfulness really is, this is a mild form of cognitive therapy. We are very close to NLP. We can have a discussion as to whether it's NLP or not. We'll call it NLP Light. And this is being specifically targeted at the moment on very young children. But at the other end of the spectrum, we've got hardened criminals who are apparently going to receive the same form of treatment. And we know there are concerns from psychiatrists and clinical psychologists, many of whom say this system is unproven. But where is this all coming from within Parliament? Well, if you read the report, this is the opening statement, a culmination of over a year of research and inquiry, including 8 hearings in Parliament, when members of the Mindfulness All Party Parliamentary Group were able to hear firsthand and question some of those who have experienced the, and there's the quote, the transformational impacts of mindfulness. So this is not about helping people become happy. This is about transforming their mental state to somebody else's agenda. And it's what that real agenda is that's one of the critical things. But we get a better picture if we come to this one. This work originated with an initiative led by Lord Richard Layard and Chris Ruan, the former Labour minister who lost his seat in 2015. They established a programme of mindfulness classes in Parliament, attended to date by 115 parliamentarians and 80 of their staff.
That possibly explains quite a lot, Brian.
I believe, Mike, and I'm not joking, I believe that what we're seeing is when we encounter MPs who are making decisions which many of us would say, this is not common sense, this is not a rational person speaking. Take local Plymouth MP Oliver Colville, who's suddenly talking about the fact that his mummy used to read him stories about hedgehogs and he's now campaigning for hedgehogs. Something is happening to the minds, the cognitive processes of our MPs, and we're now getting a clue of what's going on. So if we follow the gentleman concerned through, this is Richard Layard. This brings you to the Centre for Economic Performance. And within this report, it says this: one of our priorities is that public policy should increasingly aim at well-being. Richard Layard was on the Commission for Wellbeing Policy chaired by Gus O'Donnell. So, Mike, without any trouble at all, we're rapidly coming back into the field of Gus O'Donnell, common purpose, neuro-linguistic programming. And this stuff has been driven through Parliament.
And wellbeing. And, of course, wellbeing is right at the heart of the named person scheme in Scotland. And, of course, we don't have any definition
Correct.
For what wellbeing is. What is wellbeing? I'm going to be mentioning well-being in a moment with regard to the National Citizen Service, but this is at the heart of policy, and what are we doing to people's minds in the meantime?
I believe we are damaging people's minds. I believe we are damaging the minds of our children. Anybody who believes that application of politically controlled mindfulness, anybody who believes that is good, I think they are grossly mistaken. We need to look at the people who've decided that this is policy. We've got to look at the risks to our children, and parents in particular have got to stand up and be counted in saying, do we really want this to be going on in our schools? Mm. Now, if you haven't read it already, I'm going to encourage you to go onto the UK Column website, have a look for this article, From Magic to Madness, The Government's NLP Assault on Our Minds. We wrote this back in November 2015. There's a lot of detail of the damage that NLP is causing. And again, in this article, it's talking about NLP actually being given to members of Parliament and pushed through social services. Now, we've got a blue banner at the top of this. I'll just unfurl that banner, as it were, to show an ad which cropped up when I visited the UK Column website. And here it is: NLP practitioner training and certification. This is Richard Bandler. Have a look at the origins of NLP, and it will quickly take you into connections with the CIA, Mossad, Israel, and indeed the murder of a lady. So there's some very dark stuff going on here, but this is the speed of Google picking up on what you're searching for, Mike. So I search on NLP mindfulness, the next minute, bang, the ads are up. And we'll leave you on this one. Thank you very much to one of our viewers that pointed this article out to us, and that is that President Trump has ditched a big training course for White House staff. This was about $1 million worth of training, and it was to do basically with leadership, ethics and management. Now, what I believe this course is the American equivalent of common purpose leadership training. And for some reason, President Trump has decided, I don't want it. So maybe there's something good starting to happen at the other side of the pond.
Well, could that be the case with our youth in this country? This is the National Citizen Service. Now, the National Citizen Service is a big society initiative. It was launched in 2010 following a pilot scheme in 2009. Launching the scheme, well, guess who launched it? It was David Cameron, who was Prime Minister at the time. And launching the scheme, he said, in many societies, there is a rite of passage marking the moment that young people turn into adults, taking on board new rights and responsibilities. Oink, oink.
You better qualify that, Mike, I think.
No, I don't need to qualify it. You know, we know what his rite of passage was. It involved a pig. This is what he's talking about. Rites of passage for young people. He feels that everybody needs one. But what's interesting about that statement, of course, he's talking about new rights and new responsibilities being taken on board. So in other words, until young people have turned into adults, they don't have any rights until they get their new rights. But with those new rights come new responsibilities. This is pretty dangerous stuff. What else did he have to say? He said, National Citizen Service brings young people from different backgrounds together in common purpose. And that is absolutely what the National Citizen Service is about. It will be giving, undoubtedly giving the young people involved in it a good dose of mindfulness, perhaps some NLP. Now, the National Citizen Service, of course, doesn't do anything itself. It merely commissions courses for young people to go on. But it chooses who the course providers are. Well, the Public Accounts Committee has completed its inquiry into the National Citizen Service. And this follows an earlier report by the National Audit Office, which I think was out in January, which found that the National Citizen Service costs about three times more per head than alternative youth schemes such as the Scouts. For 2016, for example, they are expecting it to cost £1,863 for each person that goes through the National Citizen Service programme, whereas the Scout Association estimates £550 for an equivalent sort of thing. Well, the Public Accounts Committee said that the National Citizen Service had grown rapidly since the programme was piloted, and an estimated 93,000 16 and 17-year-olds took part in 2016. But they're complaining that the participation is not growing fast enough. Meg Hillier, the chair of the Public Accounts Committee, said there are considerable long-term ambitions for the National Citizen Service, a legacy of David Cameron's vision of a big society. They said that in their view, it had reached a critical juncture. And the question is, you know, the government is intending to push on with plans to grow participation, but that doesn't justify the levels of public spending on the programme. And so they're concerned mainly about the money, £475 million of public money going in to reframe young people's minds, Ryan. There's an upcoming bill going through Parliament. It's called the National Citizen Service Bill, and it's going to look once again at the trust which is behind this organisation and their management arrangements. Now, the Cabinet Office was the body that set up the NCS Trust, and it was set up as a community interest company, almost wholly funded by government. So the question is, are they going to shut it down, or are they going to demand that it raises more money from the private sector or from the third sector. It's not clear just yet, but certainly there's no foundation money in this yet. It's totally government funded. I think it was 900,000 children have been through this since 2009.
Yeah, so the speed at which this is happening is phenomenal. Thousands and thousands of children going through a government controlled citizen training, views and values that the government puts forward are what's being projected at the children. And then we use a technique such as NLP to embed ideas and values without the children really having a conscious decision in their heads as to whether they agree with what they're being told. Mm. And well, the other one we need to mention is, of course, the Behavioural Insights Team. So the British government set up this team of psychologists, applied psychologists, who eventually boasted that they had achieved the ability to change the way people thought, the way people behaved. and they were so confident in the success of these techniques that those techniques were sold to both the Americans and the Australians. So if you're not aware of this, Google Behavioural Insights team, and of course it started out within government, within the Cabinet Office, and then it then migrated sideways into a social community interest company or a social interest company. So it is still there, and this is one of the powerhouses of producing this political agenda aimed at children. So meanwhile, if we've covered children, let's bring in elderly people, because of course the big scourge at the moment is dementia. David Cameron almost boasting that we can expect over 2 million people with dementia. I think it was by 2050. He was very confident of the number. Nobody at the moment is doing any real research into dementia, and nobody of course wants to talk about the fact that elderly people in care who are being denied liquids invariably begin to show signs of dementia-like symptoms for which they're then medicated. So we're receiving more and more information that elderly people who have actually nothing wrong with them are being given dementia-like symptoms because of dehydration within so-called care facilities. Well, here we've got the Law Commission. People with dementia and learning difficulties detained in care without checks due to failing law. Now, I think, Mike, this is a scam, because we're well aware of what's going on. Elderly people are having property taken away from them. They're being told that they're not compos mentis, they're not capable of looking after themselves. Is it the public backlash which has now caused the so-called independent review by the Law Commission? We don't know. And this one also flagged up to us today, all change in the courts. So we've got business and property courts. What are they saying? From June this year, the specialist civil courts are to be known as the Business and Property Courts of England and Wales. There'll be the new name for England-Wales International Dispute Resolution Jurisdictions. So massive changes to the courts. We've been warning about changes, attempted changes to the British Constitution. Courts, of course, are part of this. And where's this going, Mike? I almost sense that they're making the courts fully corporate organisations now.
Absolutely. The Business and Property Courts will be the new name for England and Wales International Disputes Resolution Jurisdictions. Of course, the international dispute resolution schemes are the main parts of the free trade agreements that people don't like. So this rebranding in preparation for our new trade agreements with all and sundry, perhaps?
Perhaps.
But I wonder, did they pay? Did they go to a PR company and pay for that name?
I don't know. If anybody can help us out with deeper research on that, we would be very grateful, because, of course, the justice system is one of the key areas that... If we lose common law, if we lose proper courts and trial by jury, we simply have no justice left in this country.
Absolutely. Well, bit of an amusing story here. This is Charlotte Hogg, who was the CTO of the Bank of England, then became deputy governor. And unfortunately, she became deputy governor, what, 6-8 weeks ago, something like that. She's had to resign almost immediately. Because of a conflict of interest, it seems. She was brought up in front of the Treasury Select Committee, who declared that her professional competence fell short of the standards required. And basically, this is because that when she joined the bank in 2013 as Chief Operating Officer, that her brother, Quentin, was working in a senior strategy role at Barclays. But she set the bank's guidelines, which... defined how people declare conflicts of interest. And this absolutely falls under the guidelines which she herself set. But she didn't declare that her brother was working for Barclays, and Barclays is a bank that the Bank of England regulates. And therefore, she's found herself in an untenable position and has had to resign.
Can I just say, Mike, interesting headline, Hogg quits Bank of England incompetency row. This word competency came out of the European Union, as far as I'm concerned.
Yes.
Is it about competency or is it about lying?
I think it's about lying, but they said it's about professional competence. But anyway, I think I agree with you. It's about lying. What did Mark Carney say? I deeply regret that Charlotte Hogg has chosen to resign from the Bank of England.
Right.
So there you go.
Is Charlotte Hogg part of the Hogg politician family?
Not that I'm aware of, but okay. It's a good question.
All right. I won't mention piggies at all. We'll end on this one from a local paper, the Plymouth Herald. A cuddly picture there of man with his owl. BBC accused of double standards over censure of freelance contributors. Now, BBC and double standards, surely not possible. I nearly didn't read this because, of course, we're only supposed to be supporting hedgehogs in Plymouth, but I thought an owl article. So this was a key part of it. Despite regular complaints about Mr. Packham, the gentleman left, using his BBC licence fee funded position to attack people in the countryside, that means verbally attack, he has so far escaped censure. The argument put forward after he branded farmers and country sports followers the Nasty Brigade in an edition of BBC Countryfile magazine was that Mr. Packham was a freelance contributor, not a BBC employee. So that's pretty straightforward. So bring in the next bit. But an allegation of double standards has now been levelled at the corporation after they took a rather different approach with another freelance BBC presenter. BBC Radio 4 Woman's Hour host Jenny Murray was sanctioned for publishing an article in the Sunday Times about transgender people. She wrote, "Be trans, be proud, but don't call yourself a real woman." So where did this take us? Well, this is the BBC response. Responding to criticism of Miss Murray's comments, a BBC spokesperson said Jenny Murray is a freelance journalist and these were her own views. However, we've reminded her that the presenters should remain impartial on controversial topics covered by BBC programmes. So there's indeed double standards there. But if we get to the heart of what's going on here, the Herald fails to pick up on the true agenda, which is the BBC bias in favour of the transsexual agenda and against those who dare to challenge it. And we will say that the BBC is striving for heteronormativity and transhumanism. So if somebody is listening to us today within the transgender community, we will say you also need to get researching, because where the BBC is going is that really we don't want people, and it's much better if you are either totally sexless in the fullest definition of that, or you have been transformed into what, part human, part machine. I'll leave you to think about that. That brings us to the end of today's news. Thanks very much for joining us. If you're not a subscriber of the UK column, please consider taking out a subscription, because we can only do what we do with your help. Thanks for joining us. Bye-bye. Bye.